Good evening, everyone, and welcome to today's telephone town hall. I'm Christy with OEA, and I'm pleased to be on the call this afternoon with President Scott DeMauro. Today, we're going to be discussing updates on the impact of the coronavirus pandemic, new legislation related to school closings, and how OEA is supporting members through this crisis. Later, we'll be hearing from Governor Mike DeWine and State Superintendent Paolo DeMaria. Today, we'll be taking your questions live. If you have questions for the speakers, just press 0 on your telephone keypad now to be added to the queue. We'll try to answer as many questions as possible. Again, my name is Christy, and I'll be hosting today's telephone town hall. We're now calling out to hundreds of people so that way they can hear about COVID-19 updates on school closings. We're going to get started in just a moment, but for those of you just joining, if you want to ask a question on today's event, all you have to do is press 0 on your telephone keypad and be added into the queue. We're going to try to take as many questions as possible. And it looks like we have hit that critical mass point, so now without further ado, I'd like to introduce President Scott DeMauro.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to today's telephone town hall. I'm so happy that you've all taken time to join us today and really appreciate that Governor DeWine is taking time out of his busy schedule to speak with us later on in the call. I'm also very appreciative that our State Superintendent, Paolo DeMaria, has joined us on today's call as well. He is happy to hear what's on everybody's minds, and a little bit later on, he is also going to be available to answer your questions. Before we hear from them, we'd like to give you some OEA updates, including things that we're doing to ensure all our members and students have the support they need throughout this unprecedented crisis, and how legislation passed this week will affect our public schools. In a moment, I'm going to turn to OEA Vice President Jeff Wensing, who will be sharing a legislative update, and we have our lobbying team and other members of our staff on hand to help answer questions after Jeff gives his report. But before we get started with that, I just wanted to share a few personal thoughts on things that we're going through right now. And I have to begin by just telling each and every one of you how much I truly appreciate the incredible work that our members are doing in stepping up in creative ways under very difficult conditions to make sure that they are meeting the needs of their students while also taking care of themselves and their own families. This isn't easy, and we didn't have much advance notice at all that the governor was going to be issuing the closure notice a little over a week ago, or now 2 weeks ago. But it is incredible to see what you're all doing. When I talk to parents, when I talk to other people in the community, they wanted me to convey to you how much we appreciate what our teachers and our education support professionals across the state are doing. Secondly, I want to just express my appreciation to our OEA staff. This has not been easy for people working at OEA, but everybody has been working hard to make sure that all of our members have the information they need and the support and the resources that they need to get through this crisis successfully. I want to just note that Vice President Wensing has been working very closely with Patricia Collins-Murdoch, our Assistant Executive Director for the field, in working with our staff to set up Zoom conference calls so that UNISERV Council meetings can continue. You're probably starting to see invitations for those meetings. We know that in times like this, it is more important than ever that we are all connected. I also want to give a shout out to David Williams and our communication staff, working with our lobbyists and working with our education policy research member advocacy staff to make sure that we have a full range of member resources updated and provided on our website. Right now, you go to OEA's website and you'll see great links also to the Ohio Department of Education, but we want to make sure that you all are connected with information that changes every day. I also need to say that it's times like this that I think we really should appreciate the support and power of being part of a very strong national union. I have been very fortunate myself to be connected with my fellow state presidents around the country. We've been doing a lot of sharing and a lot of networking. NEA has been an incredible support, and that has been so evident in what just happened this week with significant legislation just passed today by the House of Representatives that will provide some critical support to public schools across the country through this crisis. I think as we can all admit that our schools were not equipped to just flip the switch and suddenly go to a digital learning environment. We know that the connection that students have is largely dependent on resources, and there are varying resources between districts across the state and between families. And so one of the things that has been a learning for me through this whole process is, one, we're seeing that there are a lot of inequities that existed before and a lot of inequities that are being exacerbated during this time. I know we're all working through those as best we can now, but when we get on the other side of this, we're all going to have to work really, really hard to figure out how do we address some of those gaps and opportunities for our students across the state. Through all this, there is a lot of stress. There's a lot of uncertainty, and with that uncertainty comes stress, and when we're balancing it, the needs of our own health and that of our families and our friends while still trying to do the best in our work, it's not easy. I would encourage everybody, do all you can to take care of yourselves. Stay connected to one another, and take time. Don't let the fact that we're in this distance learning environment consume you. You know, no one expects anybody to be giving 24/7 to this work. Take time to take care of yourself. And the last thing that I'll just say is I know that more than anything else, our teachers, our education support professionals, our higher education faculty really miss their students, and I'm hearing all over the place that our students miss their teachers and miss the adults that work with them and make such a difference in their lives. No technology will ever be a substitute for the power of the personal connection that exists between educators and students in our schools and our classrooms. And I just want you to know that I am going to continue to fight with and for all of you in that regard. So with those opening remarks out of the way, at this point, I'm going to ask our Vice President, Jeff Wensing, to give us a brief update on what the legislature just enacted into law and signed by Governor DeWine today in terms of a response to this coronavirus crisis. Jeff, take it away.
Hey, thank you, President DeMauro. I get the pleasure of updating you on House Bill 197. I'll be delivering kind of a top 10 list if you're David Letterman fans. So we'll start with item number one. In terms of the minimum school year, House Bill 197 allows school districts to use distance learning to make up any missed days or any hours of instruction that were caused by the closure of the schools. I remember that the governor has officially closed schools until April 3rd. We're expecting a possible extension of that. The governor has not made that call officially yet, so we will keep our ears open. In terms of item number two, House Bill 197, in terms of testing, exempts all schools from administering state tests for the 19-20 school year. We let the lawmakers know that our focus needs to be on students and to keep them engaged and to keep them learning and not on state tests, and the lawmakers agreed, so we thank them for that. Item number three, graduation. Permits schools to grant a diploma to any student on track to graduate and for whom the principal, in consultation with teachers and counselors, determines that the student has successfully completed the student's high school curriculum or individualized education program at the time of the school closure. Item number four, third grade reading guarantee. Exempt schools from retaining students under the third grade reading guarantee unless the school principal and the student's reading teacher determine the student is not reading at grade level. Item number five, House Bill 197. In terms of report cards for the 1920 school year prohibits ODE from publishing and issuing ratings for overall grades, components, and individual measure on any state report card. Educator licenses. House Bill 197 extends the validity of a license issued by a state agency until 90 days after the end of the governor's order declaring a state health emergency or until December 1st, 2020, whichever one comes first. Number 7, House Bill 97 and teacher evaluations. House Bill 197 prohibits the use of value-added measures for the 1920 school year on teacher evaluations. Furthermore, it permits a board of education to elect not to conduct evaluations of district employees, including teachers, administrators, or a superintendent for the 1920 school year. It also gives flexibility on implementing OTES 2.0. Item number 8, safe harbor. House Bill 197 establishes a safe harbor from penalties and sanctions for districts and schools based on the absence of state report card grades for the 1920 school year. Number 9, EdChoice vouchers. The law prohibits the awarding of first-time performance-based EdChoice scholarships to students who are first eligible to receive them this year. It essentially retains the 1920 list of EdChoice eligible schools for the coming school year, and the buildings will remain at about 517, and it's not going to grow over the expected 1,200-plus buildings. This is not a long-term fix or solution that we had hoped for, and we're going to keep pushing and moving away from the eligibility based on these broken report cards and to stop deducting voucher funding from public school districts. And item number 10, House Bill 197 extends absentee voting through April 28th for the March 17th primary, requires the Secretary of State to send a postcard to all eligible voters about the change, requires the County Board of Elections to send requested absentee ballots with postage paid return envelopes, allows voters who are disabled or unable to receive mail to vote at a County Board of Election. And lastly, OEA had requested the primary date to be earlier than June 2nd to avoid, to provide sufficient time for levies and levy results and to provide school leaders and making informed decisions about our educators. And that concludes my top 10 list, Mr. President, and I will throw it back to you.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. If you would like to ask a question, please press 0, and then you'll get a chance to be put into the queue. Again, press 0 if you have a question. I know there's a couple questions that we have that I want to wait until we have heard from Governor DeWine and have Superintendent DeMaria on hand to answer. So at this point, I want to first call on Sandra from Lorraine. Sandra, you have a question.
Hi, Scott. You know, it's a relief on some people because who have to renew their license, that's postponed. But what's going on with RESA? It was a rough year for them as well, you know, recording and doing all that. Have we heard what's going on with that? I'd hate for them to have to repeat it.
I'll ask if somebody from our staff can jump in on this one. I think, Daria?
Hi, this is Daria. Sandra, were you talking specifically about the RESA or the full RE program?
I think she was... thought she was done. I think she was asking about RESA and the submission of RESA requirements, but if you want to speak to both, I think that would be helpful.
Okay. So with respect to RESA, that was submitted back in January. We have not heard that those scores will not be returned. Those are done by outside of school evaluators, assessors. So we have not heard that that will change. As far as we know, that will continue. And with respect to the resident educator program, we have asked for flexibility with respect to progressing along your resident educator license. And I know Matt Dawson is on the call, and if I get this wrong, he will correct me. The way we understand it is that with House Bill 197, each person within that licensure program, because it's a four-year license, should be able to advance in their year of licensure, even with the schools being closed. That's how we understand it.
Okay, thank you very much, Daria. Next, Carrie from Springfield has a question about graduation. Carrie?
Hi, I just had a question about the testing. I know that House Bill 197 talks about how they're exempt for all the end-of-the-year tests for the 1920 school year and the graduation, you know, they can still be, if they're on track, can graduate. But how will that affect, like, eighth graders that are currently taking, let's say, algebra, or your freshmen, sophomores, and juniors that have their end-of-the-year state test that they need for their points for graduation?
Robert Davis, if you could answer that question, and then I'll invite our state superintendent, who is on the line with us, if he has anything to add. But Robert, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure thing. So the bill is passed, deals specifically with this year's 12th graders and being on track to graduate and being allowed to graduate is a local decision. It is a temporary law change. It does not address students who are in earlier grades, such as eighth grade or earlier in their high school career. That's not to say that, you know, that couldn't arise as an issue to be addressed by the legislature at a later time, but the legislation that was passed this week does not address other than our 12th graders.
Paulo, anything you want to add as far as any discussions yet about our younger classes?
Yeah, so I think the question is a great one. And in fact, the reality is there are going to be a whole host of cascading issues that emanate from some of the decisions and the reality of the circumstance that we're under. I've got different work groups working at the department, one of which is all around graduation requirements and its relationship to assessments. And so they're keeping a running list of all those kind of related issues that are going to have to be dealt with. And to the point that was made, we ultimately envision that we're going to have to deal with those you know, either through flexibility that we have or through further legislative attention.
All right, thank you. I've got a couple of people that have called in with questions related to OTES. Let me turn it to Amy from Huber Heights first.
Hi, my question was, Jeff mentioned the 20 school year, that the OTES evaluations and the data for the kids, or I'm sorry, for OTES 2.0, or what we do with that as far as safe harbor, he used the 20 school year. I didn't know if that meant 2019-2020, or since we won't have state testing, if that could be used for next year for 2020-2021.
Let me ask Matt Dotson if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. It's important to remember that the value-added progress dimension as used on OTES 1.0 is from student data from the prior year. That's just based on how long it takes to compile that data. Therefore, the 2019-20 student data would be used to calculate value-added measure used on OTES next school year, 2020-21. So that is the effect of the provision in the bill stating that when it comes to next year and teachers and value-added subjects, generally math, science, grades 4 through 8 in general, when it comes to their student growth measure, Ohio law requires that value-added progress dimension be used. But since that would be from the prior year data, you know, this year, 2019-20, which would be probably not even able to be calculated, what the bill is saying is for next year's evaluation, when it comes to those teachers who would otherwise be required to use the value-added progress dimension, that would be prohibited by this bill, House Bill 197. Teachers who are not on value-added progress dimension for their student growth measure are on some other type of student growth measure that is able to be calculated in the concurrent year, so the same year. However, I would note that due to the cancellation of testing for the rest of the school year, it is likely that teachers who are not value-added grade subject teachers and have some other type of student growth measure, it is unlikely that they would be able to have their student growth measure calculated because of the cancellation of testing. So that really speaks to other authority in the bill for school boards to elect not to conduct evaluations this year and to work with their local bargaining unit in that regard.
All right. Thank you, Matt. And I know there was another question about implementation of OTES 2.0, and my understanding is that the legislation passed this week provides some local flexibility so that there no longer will be a requirement that all school districts have to implement OTES 2.0 next year. Paulo, that's correct? Am I correct on that?
Yes, that is correct. And we'll be following up with some additional information shortly.
Okay, great. I want to turn to Lorna from Ross Hill, who has a question. This is a question I know I think she wanted to address to Governor DeWine, but perhaps, Paulo, you can speak to this. Lorna?
Hi, Scott. My question is largely because I teach in a very rural area in southeastern Ohio, and our students do not have access to internet broadband service. They don't really have cell access. And I was hoping that Governor DeWine or anyone who could possibly answer this could. Is there going to be any possibility for alternates, or I was kind of hoping somebody could tell me if there was going to be a potential for increased broadband internet service in the state to give us different ways that we could reach out to our students, because we really can't do digital learning with them because they just don't have that internet access.
Paulo, could you comment on discussions about strategies for expanding broadband access?
Sure. And again, as you can imagine, this isn't something that Ohio has wrestled with, for a number of years. And I think if you were to look at maps that showed broadband availability around the state, we've made some progress, but there are still, you know, swaths of the state that don't have that. Just recently, the lieutenant governor and I and the Medicaid director announced a pilot project to try to explore telehealth opportunities in the District Switzerland of Ohio. As many of you know, Switzerland has the largest geographic footprint of any district in the state. And he showed a map at that point that showed where those places that did not have broadband access were in the state. I think there's a general commitment at the state level to work with telecommunications providers. And I think even the federal government, especially coming out of this pandemic, and the increased attention both on the need for people to be able to connect for telehealth purposes as well as educational purposes, that you'll see some additional attention being paid to running those, you know, last mile connectivity and creating the conditions where more people can access broadband capacity where currently they don't have that opportunity. That's a long-term situation, however, because as you know, that's not something that you simply either snap your fingers or put a lot of money on the table and then can change overnight. But I'm optimistic that we'll see progress in that regard. And there's a office within our Innovate Ohio, within the governor's Innovate Ohio initiative, that is focused on the broadband issue exclusively.
Okay, thank you very much, Paulo. We have, of course, teachers and education support professionals. And Mark from Amanda Clear Creek has a question regarding how we protect our ESP members. Mark?
Yeah, hello. How you doing? This is Mark Moore from Manda Creek Sports Staff.
Go ahead, Mark.
And my question is, how do we protect our support staff, our custodians, our maintenance, our cooks, our bus drivers, not just union members, but non-union members, that are put in the line of having to do things that are above and beyond what our daily activities for preparing for this pandemic?
Hey, thanks for the question. It's a really important one. And I just want to say on this one that, you know, we were hearing from some members and locals around the state in the last week. You know, I approached Superintendent DeMaria and the department followed up to provide some clarity and guidance, really taking the governor's directives to heart and saying, hey, look, if there is work that can be done off-site that doesn't require people to actually be at the physical location of the school, then they shouldn't be asked to come to school. And I appreciate, Paolo, you sending that out. And what we're hearing is that the number of people that are actually being asked to report is declining. But that said, there are still some folks that are doing some of those essential services. Paolo, can you talk about, from the department's perspective, things that you're doing to help ensure that everybody is having their safety and health protected?
Right. And, I think a large part of the answer to the question has to do with everybody's awareness and their awareness about not only not normal safe health practices, but also in this particular circumstance. So, and you know, it all depends on the position and what people are asked to do. So obviously, food service prep staff, some number of people may have to come together to work. And you've seen the governor actually struggle with this issue, and he tries to lay it out in the stay-at-home directive because he knows that there are some essential functions that have to take place. So as much as possible, if what people are doing is they're coming in from home, they're working with the same group of people, they're going back home to the same group of people and not interacting with very many other folks. Because the first and, to me, the first and foremost issue is minimize the number of people you're encountering. And then on top of that, to the extent that you can maintain social distancing based on the recommendations, continuing to emphasize that if you are suspicious that somebody's sick or ill or shouldn't be there, making sure those people understand they should not come into work if they're not feeling well, taking those kinds of steps. And then to a certain extent, I know especially like in food service, there are some longstanding things about wearing gloves and so forth and so on, just as a normal part of food preparation. Ultimately, I also understand that there are points in time, because I've seen pictures on social media where, you know, somebody is actually having to hand a meal to somebody else. And, you know, there are going to be those instances where, as much as possible, try to make sure that that's done, you know, quickly and without a lot of, hanging around and having conversation. And again, emphasizing that, you know, if people are sick, they shouldn't be coming to the bus or the drop-off point or whatever to pick up their meals. The other thing is, you know, I think our food service workers and other ESPs, you know, are going to coronavirus.ohio.gov, checking on what the CDC is recommending and working with their supervisors and their districts to make sure if there's protective, protective clothing or gloves or whatever that they should be wearing, that that's adhered to. If you need to consult with the local health department on matters and trying to make sure that the situation is structured in the safest possible way, that's certainly appropriate.
All right. Thank you very much, Paolo. And we are standing by for Governor DeWine, who just finished his news conference, and so he will be joining us momentarily. But in the meantime, we'll continue to try to take as many questions as we can. Let me ask Jason from Field Local. You have a question related to this current situation in the Educator Code of Conduct. How are you doing, Jason?
Good, Scott. Thank you. And thank you for doing this. My question is, with the ODE and the implementation of the code of conduct and with the new section of technology, I know that our local, and as listening to all the lawyers talk about this section and how what it means and how it's supposed to be implemented throughout this process, and now this has happened, and I know that we've been asked to use our personal computers, our personal cell phones, and to make sure that we're connecting with our students, whether we use Google Hangout or Zoom. And I just was looking for some guidance on these are things that I typically, that we as leaders would typically not ask members to do, but this is unusual circumstances, and we were just curious on the ODE and how they were looking at this as well. Thank you.
So I'll just start by saying I think that, and in fact, I just had a conversation with a reporter from the Columbus Dispatch who was asking about this yesterday, and I think, you know, there are even more reasons to be concerned and use professional judgment in being careful not to cross professional lines now than there were before because of the nature of this. But let me ask, let me turn first to Superintendent DeMaria. From the ODE perspective, if there's been any discussion about, you know, any modifications to code of conduct expectations related to technology or any just general advice you would have for folks as we think about this issue?
Yeah, so a couple of things. And I think I'll start with the very last thing that the caller said, that these are extraordinary times. And you know, in some ways I'm heartened that, you know, even the governor has embraced the idea that sometimes we have to do what's right and what makes sense, and that people will understand that. So I think you're right that during normal times we wouldn't advise things to happen, but I think the things that are happening are good things. And I also know that that creates certain risks that people might come back and say, well, wait a minute, what happened here? So I think our posture is the same as it's been throughout this crisis, is to say we want to be flexible, we want to be practical, and we want to we expect people to sort of make a good faith effort to do what's right and to comport themselves in a proper manner. I do not think we've had specific conversations about the code of conduct at this particular time. You know, and part of that is because ultimately a code of conduct violation would have to sort of, you know, make its way through the process. And I think the fact, the circumstances of this particular time would be an important contextual element in those kind of considerations. That said, that about gets to the limit of my knowledge on the professional conduct side. So I would defer further questions, and maybe Scott, you and I can present some issues to my team and provide some additional information if that is important to helping people get comfortable.
All right, thank you very much, Paolo. This is also something that we are certainly having discussions with our staff in terms of making sure that we're providing the very best guidance to local leaders and to members as we can as we continue to move forward. At this point, we're going to take a break from questions because I am very honored that our governor, Mike DeWine, has taken some time out of his very busy schedule to join us and to be able to say a few words today. I know you all have probably, along with me, been watching those 2 o'clock press conferences every afternoon. And Governor, I just want to say on behalf of OEA and our 122,000 members, thank you for all that you're doing to lead us through these very challenging times. Thank you for your strong leadership. Thank you for all the ways that you're relying on experts in science to make some really difficult decisions. And thank you, as always, for putting kids first in what you do. So without further ado, Governor DeWine, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I really just appreciate the chance to say thank you to all of you for what you're doing. I know these are difficult times. But your ability to continue to teach our kids and put the lesson plans together And I've talked to a number of different people from different schools, and each one of the schools has a different challenge. I know there's a big difference between our urban, our rural, our suburban, but I just really appreciate what teachers do every day, but I particularly appreciate what you're doing during this crisis. You know, we have a son who is a teacher, has taught for a number of years. We know how difficult that is. And a little anecdote, when my wife Fran and I got married, she thought I was going to be a teacher. We got married between our second and third year at Miami University, and I was an education major, actually student taught at Princeton High School, and for four and a half months, I guess, and found out how tough that teaching was, and how difficult it is. But it's a period of time I look back on with great fondness. But I just have the utmost respect for all of you, and I'm just grateful for what you do. I know people, you wonder about what's going to happen with the school year. We don't really know, but what we announced today was the newest modeling coming out of the Cleveland Clinic would indicate that this may not even peak until the mid-May. So, you know, our projection has been late April, mid-May. It would appear, if that modeling is correct, that this will not even peak until mid-May. So, you know, I think it's unlikely that we're going to be back into the school buildings this academic year. But again, that's something that, you know, we don't want to announce that until we're sure, until we know it's at exactly, you know, where we are. We're kind of in a race right now, and that race is to try to cut down on the contacts, social distancing that we're asking everyone to practice, the rules that we put into place. That's going to have to continue. We're going to have to ask people to really continue to do a very, very good job in regard to that. At the same time, the other variable is our ability to build out our healthcare system. We believe that we're going to have to double or triple the number of beds, hospital beds, the number of ICU beds. We're now moving from the planning stage of that to the implementation stage of that. I've asked we've divided the state up into eight regions, and we've asked each region to come back with us by tomorrow morning. And they knew that this was coming, but to return to us tomorrow morning a rough draft of how that's going to work. So we're now moving into the phase of you're going to start seeing building out of our capacity to deal with this. So it's two different things going on at once. What we are trying to avoid is a situation like you're seeing on the news for New York City, for example, or you saw on the news in regard to Italy, where the whole healthcare system is just absolutely overrun. And we're doing everything we can to avoid that. So again, thank you for all that you're doing. Thank you for taking care of our kids. There's nothing more important in our lives. Fran and I, as you know, have eight children. We have 24 grandchildren. We have grandkids from one all the way up to our oldest grandson, Albert, is in graduate school. So we got them all ages and all pretty much all grades. And so we just are grateful for all that you do each and every day, and particularly what you're doing during this very, very difficult crisis. You know, this is the first time we've had anything this difficult, this kind of a pandemic, probably since 1918. So it is not only a once in a lifetime, but it's probably, we hope it's a once in a whole century. And you know, it's just been something that we're going to get through. Ohioans are strong. We're resilient. We're going to get through it. And our goal is to get through this with as few a casualties as possible. So thank you for everything that you do. I look forward to the day that we're back in the classroom and that you're able to teach inside that classroom. So thanks again for what you do. Have a great day.
Thank you so much, Governor. Governor's not able to stay with us for questions, but Superintendent DeMaria is. Paulo, I know I kind of got you into answering questions before I had a chance to introduce you.
No, that's totally fine.
Kind of going off script, but in case you didn't know, Paulo DeMaria is the state superintendent here in the state of Ohio, and I had the good fortune to interact on a regular basis with Paulo, along with my counterpart from the Ohio Federation of Teachers and other senior leadership at ODE and with State Board of Education. And so, Paulo, I just wanted to say I very much appreciate your leadership and your ongoing communication through this process. Give you a chance. If there's anything else you want to say, please go ahead, and then we'll get back to questions.
No, wanted to echo the governor's comments. Just thank you so much for everything. Teachers, service personnel, those who are manning the kitchens and the buses and the and even maintenance staff and all those important functions. I am so heartened and so encouraged by the way the education community is pulling together in this time of need and really focusing on both the future of our community and understanding that it's this health issue that we really have to have as our first priority, but also understanding that it's important to find ways to keep students connected, to continue to show our care and love and concern for them, and to continue to support their educational process and progress. So I can't express my appreciation enough for all the great things that are happening out there.
Thank you so much. So we're going to get back to questions, and I know there's a lot of questions about special education. Miriam from Lima, I know you have a question.
Yes, I do. Thank you so much for setting up this conference call. I'm sure I echo everyone else by thanking you for it. The question that I have is this. With special education, we have IEP goals and objectives that we need to be monitoring. We do quarterly assessments at interim grade time and then at the end of the estimate. Since we have been out of school, is there any way that we can put into the quarterly that we can't monitor the goals and objectives due to being out of school with the COVID virus?
I'm going to ask Daria DeNoia from OEA Education Policy Staff to respond. Daria?
Hi, Miriam.
Hi.
Yes. So I'm looking here just to double check that, yes, flexibility in that regard with respect to IEPs is allowed. You do need to document it, and you should follow your district procedures for how to document that. With that being said, if there is a way, and I don't know if there is because it will depend on your unique circumstance, if there is a way for you to assess children remotely, then that would be the way to get that piece done. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think it does. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you. Let me turn to Alicia from Whitehall, who has a graduation question.
Hi. Thank you also. We really appreciate this. My question is about graduation, and every counselor I know wants to know what the definition of on track is currently. Like, for example, we may have seniors who were on track but needed additional credits to graduate and may not have had access. Is that where the flexibility comes in with the principal and the teachers and the counselors? Or what if they had one more test to take? We're just looking for some clarification on that.
My understanding is that the laws, House Bill 197, provided flexibility for local school districts to make that determination. Paulo, anything more on that?
We are actually working on a document that our goal is to provide some clear, sort of amplification of what was in House Bill 197. Again, I'm going to continue to come back to this idea of, you know, practical and yet, you know, sort of responsible, right? So if you have a student who is, you know, 5 credits short of meeting their minimum credits, and there's really no, you know, no way they could have. Maybe they were saying, hey, I'm gonna get those credits done here in the last 3 months of school, but the likelihood of that happening wasn't going to be a lot. You know, then I think there's a practical answer to the question of could that student have accomplished what they might have set out to do. But I think Scott's point is correct. We're affording a lot of flexibility to schools, and that means principals working with teachers and counselors to call that question, but to call it responsibly. Because, you know, this is one of those situations where people, you know, people are sort of watching, and they're expecting the education community to do the right thing, but they're also going to be very responsive to the realities of the circumstance. So if here's a student that was, you know, they were taking their last English course of the 4 that they're required to take, and they had been doing, you know, good work up until the shutdown, and you know, the district is making a good faith effort to continue providing them support, and they, you know, in one way, shape, or form participate in that, then there should be no hesitancy, no qualm in saying, should they get credit for that English course? Absolutely, yes. So maybe I've just given you 2 extremes, and they're, you know, million permutations in between. And what we're asking people to do is step up, be the great professionals that you are, and make those calls, knowing full well that if somebody's really on the line, if it's, you know, if somebody says, you know, I mean, if they're really close, we're going to go ahead and let them graduate, I don't think anybody's going to criticize that decision.
All right. Thank you, Paulo. Just a reminder, press 0 if you have a question. And if we don't have time to get to everybody's questions, you will have the opportunity to leave us a message, and we'll make sure that we get an answer to as many people, as many questions as we possibly can, even if we run out of time on the call here today. We have a licensure question, and I know that some guidance just came out from ODE, Jennifer from Toledo. Go ahead. You have a question.
Hi, Scott. It's Jen Dent calling from Toledo, Ohio. Thank you for the time and doing this for all of us. My question is, I'm looking at the information that came out today that was provided to us for clarification. And as I'm reading this, license expiration extension is allowing additional time to complete their requirements for renewal. And I see the dates and the timelines that we're looking at. My question is, when it's talking about requirements for renewal, is it a particular requirement or is it all requirements for renewal?
So let me, can you talk a little bit more? You're talking about all renewals for licenses, anybody whose license is expiring this year and so is up
Correct.
For a new 5-year license. Okay. My understanding is that House Bill 197 provides a 90-day extension on that. I saw the department put guidance out today that said September 1st. There does seem to be a little bit of an inconsistency there. Paulo, can you speak to that?
No, certainly no intention to be inconsistent. It may have been that document was in process prior to the legislation. I'm sure if that's a disconnect, my guess is my staff already understands it and is working on a correction. So whatever is the provision of the legislation, our documents will align to that here shortly.
Okay, great. Thanks. I know that we have questions just in terms of our union business, and there's a whole question about contract ratification and things like that. Tim from Fairfield, you have a question.
Hey, Scott, this is Tim from Fairfield. My question centers around being able to get contract ratifications done in the event that we do not go back to school, or even if we're extended for 2 more weeks. How would we go about making sure that those are done properly.
Thanks for the question. Let me ask Eric Urban if you can speak to that.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity. So contract ratification is going to be largely governed by one of two documents, either your constitution and bylaws at the local level or the OEA elections and ratification manual. Both of those are available to your LRC, and many of you probably have them somewhere in your files. So I would encourage you to look at your constitution and bylaws as the first place to go with respect to how to ratify your contract. If it is not specific or it just references the OEA elections and ratification manual, then you have a number of different opportunities in order to do small group meetings. You could do drive-by voting. There's a number of creative ways that you can ratify your collective bargaining agreement, assuming two things. First of all, that all of your members need to understand what is actually in the tentative agreement. And secondly, they're all given equal opportunity to ask questions and to have those questions answered electronically or otherwise in order for them to make an honest and good decision around what they're voting on. So you follow those guidelines, follow your constitution and bylaws, and if it is silent or doesn't give a great deal of specificity, work with your local LRC to come up with the most creative but fair and balanced approach you can in presenting that contract to your members for ratification.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that, Eric. We have a number of OTES-related questions. I'm going to turn to Jen from Delaware.
Hi, good afternoon. I had a question about OTES 2.0. So my district was slated to implement it starting in August for the next school year. I know districts are being offered flexibility in implementing it now. Do we have more details about that, such as a specific date or other criteria regarding implementing 2.0?
Let me ask Eric if you or Matt. Eric, why don't you start, and then if Matt Dotson has more information.
Sure. So my understanding of House Bill 197 and the information that's been shared indicates that the state superintendent is eligible or able to delay the implementation of OTES 2.0. Our understanding of that is that it would be, should you so choose, and there's an agreement between the union and the board that would be extended for 1 year, so it would not be implemented until the 21-22 school year.
All right. Courtney Johnson has another OTES-related question. Hey, Courtney.
This is Courtney Coleman.
Oh, Courtney Coleman. Sorry. Courtney Coleman,
okay.
You had an OTES-related question. Sorry.
Well, yes, I do have a question. Are we correct in hearing that the bill gives school boards flexibility with teacher evaluations, which I think he's covered some of that, and can use online teaching in quarter four as part of this year's evaluation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I don't believe that, there is an expectation that we're going to have essentially a free-for-all when it comes to OTES evaluations, given these circumstances. Eric, can you comment on that in terms of how observations in the OTES process should be handled?
At this point, we're still putting together a model MOU that can be presented to school boards, superintendents, and having discussions between the local union and the leadership of the school district in order to determine how they're going to proceed moving forward. We have not moved from our recommendation that we are taking a wait-and-see attitude and nobody should jump to doing something other than what the law allows or requires. And at this point, our understanding, again, of House Bill 197 indicates that there is an opportunity to declare the evaluation process if you have not completed it prior to March 16th when schools were closed. You have the opportunity to declare that it's not impracticable or it's impossible to complete the evaluation, thereby sort of canceling OTES for the 19-20 school year.
All right, thanks. I think we have one more time for one more question, but anybody who had already called in, we want to make sure that that we capture your question and we get a chance to try to respond to it. And let me ask, let's see here. There's a really good question. I'm just lost. I'm looking at my list. Judy from Clinton Massey. I think we might have talked about your issue, but go ahead with your question, Judy.
Thank you for doing this, first off. It's kind of already been mentioned. We are a very rural school district. Teachers, staff, students have very limited high-speed internet. Some of our students have no internet at all. It's a real problem with trying to do distance learning, providing especially accommodations for low wealth, at-risk, special needs students. I kind of wanted this for the governor. I don't know if there's a, I know they kind of talked earlier, you know, about the rural area, if there's a broadband initiative for the 2020s. I don't know what can be done. I mean, I know there's nothing right at this moment, but I think it's something that needs to be looked at in the future. We have, you know, a lot of kids. I mean, I'm trying to do distance learning, but it's difficult for a lot of our families. We've got two parents working from home and, you know, three kids all trying to work with very, very low bandwidth.
Paulo, can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure, a little bit. I mean, you know, because, again, we've seen a lot of creative approaches that don't necessarily involve technology, as odd as that sounds. And yet it involves, you know, extra steps. I grant that. And so how do you make it so that you can distribute things to students that can give them enough that they need to work on, and then find ways to stay connected, right? I mean, because even you know, teachers you know, I've seen some of the you know, buses that are going out distributing food also may have, you know, assignment packets or other methods are being used. I even think I saw one place where they're using just regular mail. And as while that may sound slow, it's you know, it's one way to stay connected or at least get things into the hands of students. And then calling, you know, students to you know, even if it's just to check in on them to make sure they have the assignment, if they have any questions, you know, using a lower level of technology, because part of that also has a social emotional payoff. Kids are at home and they're missing their teachers and they're missing their school climate, and knowing that somebody out there is thinking about them and checking in on them, I think that has a whole bunch of value. One of the other things that we're seeing is sometimes ESCs are you know, especially if you're served by an ESC that has a lot of communities that look like yours, this is one of those great times where people sharing with each other strategies that are working, and again, strategies that may not necessarily rely on the internet or on technology, that can be productive and actually support students in continuing their learning activities. And I also am the first one to recognize that's a lot harder for a kindergartner than it is maybe for a high school student, or you know, for a middle school student. So you know, the way we phrased it in our guidance was, you know, our goal is to have people make a good faith effort to create learning opportunities for students that are meaningful. And you know, we're also seeing people saying, let's leverage, it's starting to be spring, are there, you know, project approaches that you can take where kids are, you know, going outside or you know, visiting places that are nearby. Again, sometimes it just takes that a collaboration among teachers to really have creative ideas about what are those ways that we can continue to foster educational pursuits and thinking in our students, even though they may not be able to connect with us online.
All right. Thank you for that. That is all the time we have for questions. Again, I want to remind everybody that you can still leave a message with your questions so that we don't miss any and we can try to respond. I just want to say again how proud I am of the incredible work that our 122,000 members are doing through these difficult circumstances, how proud I am of the work that my fellow officers, Jeff Wensing, Mark Hill, our executive director, Cheryl Mathis, and all the staff of OEA are doing. Thank you so much, Superintendent DeMaria, for taking the time to be with us and for continuing to communicate and lead through these challenging times. And again, my thanks to Governor DeWine for his time and his leadership. At this time, I'll just turn it over to our moderator, Christy, for just our closing comments.
All right. Again, thank you to everyone for being on the call, and thank you to the speakers for getting on this call to address questions from our participants and for their great shows of leadership at this time. There were so many great questions that we didn't have time to get to today, but we want to hear from you. Please stay on the line after the event, and you'll be able to record a message for us. Thank you all so much, and have a great weekend.